Welcome to Tube Talk, the show dedicated to helping you become a better video creator so you can get more views, subscribers, and build your audience. Brought to you by vidIQ. Download for free at vidIQ.com.
Oh, yeah! Welcome back to another episode of Tube Talk presented by vidIQ. I am your host, Viper, the man about tech, executive producer of social media here at the IQ. And last week, we were privileged to a very amazing conversation between our very own Rob Wilson and YouTube strategist Mario Jules. So this week, we're going to continue with the second part of their conversation where they dive a little bit deeper into YouTube analytics and what metrics you should be looking at and how to understand those metrics and get the maximum out of the information that you need to grow your YouTube channel. So with that out of the way, let's roll to the podcast.
Is it possible to kind of subvert this social proof in that you almost celebrate the fact that you're not a big channel or you have like a lot of credibility? And how I mean that is, let's say a YouTube education channel wants to start, but of course, the very thing that they need for credibility, views and subscribers, they don't have. So they could position themselves as a noob YouTuber, and I'm going to take my audience on a journey with me. So like we're going to talk about how to get my first subscriber and celebrate my 10th subscriber. And are there any other sort of ideas in that sense that kind of work?
You can use for smaller channels the lower underdog story. So right, if you do character development, and this is where you look into character development, you are a character. So if you take this mission like, oh, we're going to make the top, and there's a few channels who have done this, right? I think one of the things that, I mean, Eric had kind of a good start, but he eventually started aiming for that 10 million, right? But even if you're a smaller channel, you can use that underdog story to generate that close audience that cheers for you. And this makes them sympathetic towards you. And that is a really great thing. So to create this connection with your audience. So that's one way you can do it. However, you have to be clever with this one. So it has to be like something like character development. Else, I don't believe it will. Except for one exception. If you make it a comedic bit. As a comedic bit, this could make your content fun. Right? And so you can... There's some hacky ways to work with it, but I would encourage people to be very careful with it because it quickly could send a message or a signal towards your viewers that, hey, others have not approved of my content. I'm not as relevant, and therefore I am not the creator for you to watch. So use it cleverly, and then you create more connection or it helps your content.
We've already spoken about some metrics in passing, but you are fascinated by data. What should creators focus on? Like if there was one metric in the YouTube studio that's the one that the North Star, what would that be?
It's very simple. It's views. Views is the success metric of all success metrics. There's two other ones that I do like though. One is just how your audience chart behaves. I like that one as well because it gives us insight and how your audience segments itself. That's also one way to look at it, but there is just one golden metric, and that is views. It just, you can't beat views.
And why is that? Is there a simple way to explain that?
Yeah, so I thought about success metrics because there are some large creators who use watch time, for example, and some people create revenue. I think automation channels would use revenue as their main drive. Yeah. But the reason why I chose views as my success metric is because it is not as easily manipulated as the other ones. I'll give an example. If you have a video, if you have 1,000 views and you want to create more watch time, you don't always necessarily have to improve the quality of your video. You could just add 2 minutes at the end and bam, your watch time has increased. So it's very easy to kind of find ways around putting more effort and making your content better. With revenue, it's the same thing. You can simply change niches or make your videos longer. And that way you increase your RPMs and therefore your video will generate more revenue. So those are hacky ways in order to increase those metrics. But views is not necessarily the same. Views isn't as easy as you just increase the length of your video, therefore your views go up. There are cases like that that would happen, but in the majority of times, it is the metric that is hardest to manipulate and hardest to also grow. And that's why I think it's such a great one. It's also representative of the reach of your video. Watch time isn't representative of reach. Now, when could you pick one of the other ones if the goal is different? If you have, for example, already maximized your audience, then yes, you can go to watch time or you can go to revenue as your success metrics, as that's what you're trying to improve on. Yeah. But most people are just trying to gain more views.
Let's talk about a click-through rate and average view duration. Like, why might there be not the best analytics or misleading?
Every time I hear those words, I just get allergic.
Like, if I said to you, Mario, my click-through rate is 12%. Is that good? Question mark.
I would say a very simple answer. You're asking the wrong question.
Yes.
So this is the thing, right? In order for a metric to work, we need to see how it correlates or how it relates with our success metric. And I'm going to try to explain this very simple, very easy. We want to know if metric A, such as CTR, goes up, does metric B, our success metric, aka views, go up? Meaning, if we see an increase in CTR, do we actually see an increase in views? Or maybe the other way around, which is called negative correlation. Maybe we see a decrease in CTR means an increase in views. But whatever it is, we're looking for some relationship between these metrics. If that relationship isn't there, which in almost all cases on an individual channel basis, it isn't really consistently there, then that metric kind of goes up in the air and it doesn't have much meaning. And this is unfortunate. This kind of is a bummer because everybody says it like, and everybody wants these metrics. But unfortunately, when you do the analysis, you notice that that relationship is just not there. And it sucks, but it's not YouTube's fault because it is a data issue. I want to say that because it's so easy to throw trash at YouTube, but they're running an algorithm that does things a certain way and that is selecting certain audiences. And when they mesh that together, it just creates a number. So it's an unfortunate thing dealing with data. But hey, in order to grow, it begins with understanding the truth behind numbers, and then we can really grow.
I see. Let's talk then not necessarily about a number, but more a graph. And YouTube does hint that this ties into viewer satisfaction. It's an analytic they don't provide you with, but they talk a lot about it in terms of why viewers watch content and have recommended certain content. I'm sure we're all aware of the classic hockey stick. You know, you lose a lot of views in the first 30 seconds, then it kind of levels off. But how can you maybe take us into a little more detail about what we could look for beyond the hook and the end?
So this is what satisfaction is. Satisfaction is just any signal that shows that our audience was engaged, right? Or that audience was interested. Any positive signal, and that then leads to more signals, is a sign of satisfaction. If somebody continues to watch for 5 more seconds, they're satisfied, most likely, or they're giving it a chance. But, you know, if they weren't somewhat satisfied, they would click out. If their satisfaction is completely lost. So this is how you have to think about satisfaction in the end. That means if somebody watched your video and they enjoyed it, they're satisfied. And we can see that with retention. We can see, by the end, is still 40% watching or is only 10% watching? Well, in that case, if only 10% by the end was watching, we know that 90% kind of left early. And that's like leaving a restaurant early. If you were really enjoying a restaurant experience and you get this amazing food, you'll stay until the end. But if you leave early, there is something holding you back. So even though the metrics are hard, this is still a great indication. If people click more, they're satisfied with the attention that you grab. Now, they're just interested. This is less. There's interest, engagement, satisfaction. Interest is how you capture that. Engagement is how do you maintain that. And satisfaction is that after feeling of how we felt after watching something on the moment or after watching a video.
Another thing you talk about is audience segmentation. Can you explain that a little bit and how creators can understand it and use it?
So I'm going to paint a picture here of a concert. If it's not just a crowd of 100,000 people, right? There's people with red shoes. There's people with blue shoes. And the same way that we do that one, we segment our audience into different groups and we try to group them. So there's five main categories and how we can segment our audience. And there's a lot of resources online for people to look into if you really want to understand this. So that's the beautiful thing. There's demographics. This is really understanding who our audience is, right? What's their age? What's their gender? All those kind of things. Then we have geographic. It's understanding which part of the world they are from. So this is how you adjust which language you use, or which type of words or saying you use, or cultural relevant references, for example, you use. If you want to appeal to wider segments, you do that. Then there is the psychographics. And this is just our interest needs. So this is really understanding where's the interest of our audience, all those kind of things. This is the most complicated one, but this is where we can look at signals of what topics do they find more interesting like that. The fourth one is behavioral factors. And behavioral factors is more what's the traffic source they're using? Are they search viewers or are they more browser suggested viewers? So what's their behavior looking like? How do they watch? Do they skip a lot or do they like to watch lengthy? Those kind of signals. And the last one is something that is not often talked about, and that is their cognitive ability. In business, you always have the first four, but this one I had to include because this is our ability to focus. You know, if we look at our attention spans, right, how long can we maintain somebody's attention before they get bored, for example, or before their brain starts to get bored, because I like to refer to the brain. And I think one other one that is a little bit harder to talk about is intelligence, because intelligence relates to how easy do we have to make something to understand, right? If you have a very complex explanation, only a select group of the population may understand that. And that's why we often want to simplify our explanations and take them step by step so that the majority of people actually understands what we're trying to say. So that's the fifth one. So those five, if we want to go to a wider reach, get more viewers, those are things we can look at like, hey, how do we appeal to more people within a certain type of segmentation?
This is probably quite a new concept for most people watching this video. So if there was one of those five that you described, which would be like the lowest hanging fruit to tackle first?
The lowest hanging fruit that is easiest is simply demographic. So this is where you look at age and gender and where you try to just understand what does my age group really like? Maybe I'm trying to appeal to an all broad audience, but in reality, this type of content only applies to men, right? If you make men shaving videos, you can't really appeal to other people in this sense. But if you, for example, have just general, you know, looking fresh and good, and you notice that 90% of your audience is men, well, at that point, you have a clear signal. Maybe I need to put some effort into removing a few little pieces that make it cater to only men and then appeal to more of an audience. That would be the easiest one to tackle.
That's an interesting question, though, because we're getting into the conversation of target audience here. And, you know, there are other educators who would say, let's create a perfect target audience person. We'll give them a name and we'll give them an age and what's their history, their fears, their goals, what job do they do, how much money do they earn. Do you kind of subscribe to that idea of like the ideal viewer, or do you think this audience segmentation should be looked at in a sense of how to increase my, I guess, total addressable market?
So it depends on what your goals are, but I don't like to paint a picture that is like specific, this is the viewer, that's their education, because that is segmentation for the sake of segmentation. And I think that is you're niching yourself down before you even reach that audience. You just have to think way broader than that. And there's two ways that you can do that. One is just, hey, what interests do they have in common? Right? So somebody who plays soccer could be interested in making pancakes, and somebody who makes pancakes could be interested in watching soccer. So that's the beautiful thing about humans. We're interested in so many things. So don't try to over-segment and over-niche yourself to a specific viewer. Instead, try to think, what do people have in common? And that is what I'm trying to target. And the second part is, and this is a beautiful one, is looking at the hierarchy of needs. This one I find very fascinating because this is a complicated one, but also easy. If we look at that one, we can identify sometimes with challenges videos, for example, people care more about the aspect of survival and stuff, and that makes it so interesting. Some people, is, for example, in the attraction niche, right? In the fitness niche, you know, we can look into this needs of belongingness, which means I'm trying to be more attractive to the other gender, for example. That's their needs. So when we make videos, we just have to think that's the underlying need they have. So as long as we help them with that, we're going to be good. Now I'm going very specific here, but in general, these are some of the things that you can think about.
I'm just imagining now, Mario, a thumbnail and title appearing on my YouTube homepage along the lines of, I became a Premier League footballer on a diet of maple syrup pancakes.
Listen, and I would click. A million people would click.
It should happen, right? It should happen.
Yes.
Right. Retention. I'm going to read off a list of things that you've described in improving retention by focusing on these following categories. If we went through all of these, we'd be here until tomorrow. So I want you to maybe pick like the top three and go into these a little more detail. But Mario's suggesting like to create the perfect video, you should be looking at storytelling, visuals, music and sound, editing techniques, scripting, including narration, content selection, content types, wide appeal, which is audience segmentation, pacing, audience psychology, YouTube analytics, script writing, camera, branding, character development, and content segmentation.
You're asking me to pick between my favorite kids, you know? Yeah. They're like, and I have a big family here, you know? I'll try to pick my favorite kid. So my favorite, I would say anything visuals, simply because YouTube is most of the time a very visual experience. So understanding how we do visual storytelling is key. The second thing is I have to state storytelling. Storytelling is more than just telling a fancy story. It's the passage of information, which is the reason why if we're good at that one, we're better able to hook people. The third one, I think I'm going to have to go for wide appeal, simply because most people, this is maybe a bias because this is what people that I work with want. They want more views, and wide appeal is the go-to in order to increase the amount of views that you're actually going for. But if I may pick, like, I'm going to give a bonus shout out to one of my kids here. That bonus shout out has to be just content selection. I mean, being able to choose what content you're going to give to the audience is very, very important as well. But again, you're making me choose between my kids. So, I mean, like, this is going to be difficult.
I want to add a bonus one as well, only because if you remember before we had this conversation, I asked you to use the best microphone you could use because audio, I think, is also very important. Like, let's be honest, you haven't got the most attractive visual background, but that's not important because we can hear you very clearly. And, you know, if you were like peeking and the sound was really annoying, that might turn off the viewer as well. So I just want to add that little...
Yes, it's time for changing the visual idea.
Let's go into some more specifics a little bit then in terms of music and sound to enhance the viewer experience. Like quick hacks for each of these.
Could you repeat the question?
So I'm going to go through like a couple of questions, but like maybe let's just have like some simple hacks for each one.
Okay.
So for music and sound to enhance the viewer retention.
So this is where you have to make a difference. So one of the things is this: music is amazing to grab attention for longer. Retention is part of grabbing attention. And when we did a small research I did a few years ago, I found that when we use music, we can increase retention for 25% for those same bits. Oh, that's a significant number. Yeah. So I would say that's worth it. One downside to this, in educational content, you have to be very aware because research also shows that when we use music, we may help the viewer struggle with actually remembering what we're saying, which could actually hurt our content. So it depends on what type of content you make though.
And editing techniques.
In editing techniques, I want to put some attention towards J cutting and L cutting. It's a very specific technique, but it's not often used. So the idea of J cutting and L cutting is making the audio come in before the visuals or making the visuals come in before the audio. And you can always envision this as a J that follows the audio coming in first, and then the other thing that looks like a little bit of a J. And the L cut that is pretty much when the visuals come in. You have that little bit of an L that you see there. And the reason why this is important, because you can completely change the interpretation of those cuts based on that one. Now, how does this work? Let's say we have, we're standing here, me and you are talking, and a train is coming in. I hear the audio already. Now I built anticipation, so I already know what's coming, and we know that me and you hear that train coming, so most likely we're going to step aside and let that train pass by. But imagine we're having that same scene, and now that train is already being shown coming in, but there's no sound yet, and we just hear us talking. At that point, we're foreshadowing that this train may crash into us, and this builds suspense, because that could be a bloody scene unless I look to the right and I'm like, hey, there's a train coming for us. So that is how we can use J-cutting and L-cutting in order to change the meaning of a scene. And you can make of this all you want, but it's a fantastic tool they use in film all the time.
What role does branding play in retention, and like, how can we improve it?
So when we think about branding, it is about a unique style. And this is where I go to not interest, but interesting. So what makes something interesting is often because it's more unique, it's different. When something is different, we naturally find it more interesting. Internally, I call this objective interest versus subjective interest, or objective interesting versus subjective interesting. And this is simply where we provide a style that is unique and that creates like this new experience that we haven't really seen before. So if you copy somebody, copy them and make it your own. It's the best advice you have in order to create that unique branding and give people feeling like this video is more interesting than others.
This episode of Tube Talk is brought to you by the vidIQ mobile app. You can download it for free on the Android or iOS app stores. And it's here to help you do things like keep track of your competition, research your next video idea, optimize videos you've already posted, and more, all on the go. This is the perfect app to have literally in your back pocket while you're out and about and you find yourself with a few free extra minutes. Having the opportunity to sit down and optimize your latest video or research ideas for your upcoming video can be a game changer and save you a bunch of time as you work to create more YouTube content. Again, you can download the vidIQ mobile app for free on Android or iOS. Just search for vidIQ.
Let's think about now something that we've been talking about quite a lot throughout Mario is like character development, storytelling. That was the very first thing we mentioned here. Like how can this be used in YouTube videos? And I guess more importantly, how can it be used where people assume that it can't be? Like particularly utility channels, education search channels, they're always thinking, I can't make a story out of how to unblock a toilet or tie a tie.
So let's begin with character development. So character development is often we want to watch somebody's story who we like. And this, it doesn't matter what channel you can make people like you. So for example, one of the tactics that I've used with a client of mine is that he was always giving information. And I'm like, okay, let's break this up with one joke in your video. One simple wordplay, something that goes wrong. What that does, it removes that barrier of seriousness now. And that might make them like you a lot more. And we started working with it, and it works. No retention losses or anything like that. It works fantastically. And people, we looked at the active audience, and they seem more relaxed with them. Right? Actually, we see an increase in viewership as well. But that is one way that we can work on our character likeness. There are multiple ways. But if we look at a movie, and there are researchers that have looked into how popular are movies? And we actually, what has been found is that not only movies become significantly better rated whenever we have characters that we can better identify with, better like. Identify is a little bit on the verge, but we really like likable characters pretty much. And we can become likable characters, such as inserting a joke, showcasing that you're a good person. In storytelling, you have this thing called Save the Cat, which is a moment where we show our superhero be very good old grandma across the road. So that's character likeness. Character development is, we're all characters and we need to make ourselves presentable as a character that people like and want to follow. Now in storytelling, the best tip that I have with storytelling here is that storytelling is simply passing on information. Storytelling isn't making fancy shots, having fancy words. Storytelling has never been that. if we look into evolutionary psychology, we can actually find that story is just a way to process information that helps with our survival. So if you want to be a good storyteller, this is also for informational content and entertainment content, don't focus so much on making things sound fancy and suspense and this, that. It may help, but that's not the way to tell a good story. Your role is just to make sure that at no point in your video, I am confused, I am lost, there's too much information or too little information so that I lose immersion. That's your goal. So that by the beginning to end, I can look at the video, I'm like, that was a good video, here are five things that I liked about it. Rather than, that was a good video, but I don't remember anything. So that's your goal as a good storyteller.
So this next question is to kind of prize out your thoughts on end screens. But the question is phrased like this. What are some underutilized strategies for increasing views on YouTube videos?
We're going to go the hacky route here, but end screens are amazing. So end screens, if you optimize them well, they can be part of 5% of your traffic. They can be 5% of the whole traffic. Actually, let me phrase that one again because that was a little weird.
Yep.
So end screens, they can be 5% of your overall traffic, even on large channels. And when you don't use them, you're literally losing an opportunity to grab all those viewers. So end screen optimization is often neglected, and especially with big channels. Smaller channels, they try to hack their way into it, but yeah. Big channels with a million subs, if you score 10 million views in a month, well, you just missed out on 500,000 views just because you didn't put 5 seconds into placing an end screen.
I have noticed this when I push for end screens, and smaller channels will say, yeah, but my favorite creator doesn't have end screens. And it's like, well, that's their loss. You're right. They could be gaining so many more views. Is there any sort of basic concepts around end screens, like in terms of elements, how to deliver the end screen to get people to click?
So end screens, I've done some research, but it's been years since I've optimized this one, but it worked so well. And that is my advice is always this. Pick two end screens so it becomes a good choice that we have. One of those end screens, make it something that relates closely to the video they just watched. And the other one, pick either most recent video, best for viewer, or something that you want to drive traffic to. The goal isn't to get both of them high amount of views, right? The goal of having both is to provide the viewer with a choice. That's the only thing, right? And then this end screen overlay doesn't do very much. So it is actually still encouraged to tell people about the end screen or anything that, and we do see when we analyze this that often just pointing to your end screen or giving a call to action, simple one, does increase the amount of clicks for a lot of creators. So that's the easy trick here, really.
All right. So this is the one, Mario, where I really want to challenge you on it. Okay. Because I 100% agree that you should be using end screens, but how I've developed my end screen strategy is one single end screen that's very intentional. So let's say, for example, we did a video about how to start a brand new YouTube channel. And then I might finish the video by saying, now this is very useful, but now you've got to make your first video. And this is 150 tips on how to make the best videos for your channel. End. But I think if you have two end screens and you don't really reference one, the viewer may be paralyzed by choice. You just want them to do one single thing. So that's my, I guess, counter argument to two choices. So how would you respond to that?
I believe that you may have a good point when it comes down to stating an exact video and you're putting extra effort into a singular video because you're providing context.
Yes.
Right? So that's where I can see that this could be a valid strategy for some, and I'm not going to discredit it because I have not seen numbers that it doesn't work. So therefore, I want to say that that could be a very good one. I have not seen which is the best yet. And some viewers prefer something different, so maybe that won't work for you. And I think it's a good strategy. The other thing that I want to say is that the reason why two end screens works is because we may think that our viewer is interested in something similar.
Fair such point.
Yep. Or maybe they are looking for something new. Mm. And what we're doing is we're still providing them a choice with, do you want something similar or something new? Because else it is, do you want this one or do you want out? And we don't want them out. So I think your strategy is still a good strategy. I don't see any flaws with it. And I always say, like this, if I don't have data to prove you wrong, I should keep my mouth shut.
but what we agree on is having four elements up there. As you say, the standard templated screen, like thanks for watching and having an elongated outro. It's like, just get them to that next video, whatever is, and don't give them too many choices.
No, you should have 12 elements. It's the minimum, bare minimum. Every creator does it. No, don't do that.
Let's talk about traffic sources. Again, I think we'll all agree the general consensus is search isn't where you want to be as a creator long term. It may help you get discovered, but you're not going to really build a hardcore audience behind that. You want to try and transition your audience to browse unsuggested. But you're saying that browse traffic is just as important as suggested, where that might not have been in the past. And the difference between the two is suggested videos are when you are watching a video, you get a column worth of videos you can choose from. Browse is where you're on the homepage and you're just seeing a random selection of videos and you choose which one to watch.
So I thought for the longest time, and this has almost always been true, that suggested is what you should aim for. It is the discovery of new things. It's you're already watching something and that's where we see something. But YouTube's algorithm has been getting really good at curating people to write videos through browse, even if they've never watched this creator.
Yeah.
And this recently, I had a moment where I was sitting with somebody and I told him, look, you have to go for suggested. Let me show you the data. And I popped up the data and I was like, wait, this is not a story that I've been seeing before. And that got me analyzing, and suddenly the story has changed. And it seems to be that equal browse and suggested can get you new viewers. And this is amazing news. I love it, because else the suggested type of content wins. Now all types of content has a place where it can win. So it's amazing, but that's what the data is currently showing.
Is there a difference between appealing to a browsed-based audience or a suggested-based audience? Because what I find is smaller channels, and when I say smaller channels, like even a channel of maybe 10,000, 20,000 subscribers, or maybe it's more based on views, let's say they're getting 1,000 views per video, 10,000 views per video, they struggle to still get into the suggested videos, but are fine with browse or the other way around.
So the main difference between browse and suggested is that the audience intent.
Yes.
So what kind of behavior do we have? So on browse, we have to think these are people that are still exploring and they're seeking some new content, right? While on suggested, on the side there, they're more, maybe I'm interested, maybe I'm not. They're not necessarily certain that they're looking for more content. They may go there for more content. And that is where we draw the difference. So when YouTube suggests things through browse, those could be really good for making people want to watch content. And if you are a creator they've seen before, they're going to be likely to click on that if they enjoyed the past video of yours. But let's say they're watching that video of yours and now they see some random things on the site, they might be up for something new. So this is just the only big difference that you have there is just fewer intent. Specific strategies haven't necessarily been developed, and all strategies that are specific for those kind of things, there's like mixed signals in the research. Some show this strategy works, but on the other time it doesn't show. So I unfortunately don't really have any good strategies that specifically target one or the other than make it appeal to every type of audience and make interesting videos as simple as it sounds.
What about the difference between new and returning viewers? That's a more modern metric. Any value specifically to that?
So the main reason why we want to focus on new and returning viewers is simply because new viewers are people that we want. Oh, I'm going to try it one more time. Sorry, I got distracted. So the main thing we want to focus on with new and returning viewers, and that's why it's such an amazing thing, is because we're trying to optimize to appeal to anybody who's never seen our content. So we want to make sure that we don't have references to past videos, as well as viewers who have already seen our content, where we want to create a familiar experience, which you already enjoyed before, and then we want to add a little bit of novel thing in there, to create some freshness. So we want to always make your content appeal to both. And the good, fun thing is that in your YouTube dashboard, YouTube has added something new. They've added data for new and returning viewers, and they'll continue to add data, as far as I know, for new and returning viewers that you can use actually to help you make decisions and see, oh, I am not reaching new viewers. So then you know, maybe I'm just catering only to the people that I've watched before. And if you're only reaching new viewers, then maybe the experience wasn't satisfying enough that people want to come back. And this is a great metric to look at.
And then...
One second. Oh, I've got to say something.
Hello, testing. 1, 2, 3. Okay. Hello.
You cannot hear echo, right?
I cannot hear echo, no.
Perfect.
Okay, good. So the next question I was going to ask is average views per viewer. I have wanted to try and understand this metric more, but it's so buried deep in YouTube's analytics that I don't know, maybe I'm just wasting my time, but I feel as if, as an extension of return viewers, if I could find out how many videos have been watched per viewer and try to improve that, that would be worth it. But is there any, have you done any research into this? I'm curious.
So I have also looked at average views per viewer, and my first thing was, is there a correlation between performance? Because, and it sounds so good as a metric, and I want it to work, but I haven't found it just yet. And I think the reason is because of the other biases that we have with selection biases, stuff that play a role. But I do believe that if we could find, for example, average views per viewer for specific subgroups such as returning viewers or new viewers, or when we start looking in that direction, I believe there's something somewhere. It's going to be very specific, but I believe there must be something somewhere that we can see, or how many videos after this video, how many videos did it end up generating for this viewer? And now we're going in unicorn land, but I do believe that there is something there that we can use. It's just something that requires us to think, and YouTube also to figure out, hey, is this useful or not? Because they have a lot more data than we do, so they can experiment. But it is if somebody's willing to rewatch an entire thing, that is a good signal. And if so, but we also don't really know how is average views per viewer, how is that calculated? Because one of the things we have to think about, how is a view calculated? And unfortunately, this is where YouTube does not openly say how a view is calculated, and is understandable, because else people like us are going to be like, oh, let's figure out the tricks. but we have to figure it out. But that's the beauty of it. We'll figure it out. Either YouTube gives us new metrics, or we'll figure out a metric.
One of the recent metrics that everybody wanted to know how to hack was swiped versus swiped away in shorts. Like, oh, right, what's the distinction between the two? You know, is it a video length? And I asked YouTube, and they said, we want to keep that specific data to ourselves. And you can kind of understand why.
That's a call to action. It's like a Batman sign for us. Like, hey, figure it out. And we're there.
In 2024, Mario, do you think subscribers as a metric on the platform, I'm not talking about how you can use it for vanity metrics to get awards or like reach out to businesses, do you think subscribers are of any use on YouTube?
Unfortunately, the algorithm is getting so good that subscribers have limited impact. The only way that I could really see subscribers play a role is some social proof. Maybe they're like, oh, this guy has 2 million subs. That works really good. But other than that, the algorithm is so good at curating the right videos for the right viewers that subscribers start to matter less. And people know that. And it's more, they look more at the views that a video has generated rather than the amount of subscribers. If a video has 1 million views, but the channel has 5,000 subs, we'll still watch that because there's enough social proof. But if the video has 5,000 views and this channel has 2 million subs, then there's less social proof and it may be different. I think the days of subscribers are not over because they still have some merit. And I must say, in the end, it still feels good to know that you've got a lot of subscribers. But more than that feeling, I'm not sure how much it really does for growth. So unfortunately, that's where we have to say like a very bitter goodbye to the meaning of subscribers.
Is it far more important to have a viewer watch one of your videos and be in their watch history than them clicking on the subscribe button?
I believe it is way more important that is yes. that they have watched your content, for that they've watched multiple videos, that they've watched you on a Sunday evening, than some simple subscribe button. So if you're trying to hack subscribes by pushing fake subscribers, that's not going to do much. Unfortunately, this make great content and YouTube will get you all the views that you want. And this is where, that's where the game's at. Optimize for interest, engagement, and satisfaction.
So Mario, with a retention graph, we tend to look at the curve at the beginning and maybe the curve at the end. What do you as a strategist look at?
So I have three main things that I look at. And those are the simple spikes and dips. That's like your level one type of retention analysis. You know, are people rewatching? What do they watch more? And where are they tuning out? The second one is what I like to call sustained loss of engagement or sustained engagement. This means for longer periods of time, how are we losing them over a minute? How are we maintaining their attention over a minute? And understanding what happens before, when does it start, what happens during, when does it end, and what happens afterwards, and why don't we continue to lose viewers, for example? That's the second part. So that's level two of your analysis. Level three, which everybody should actually do, but it's the more complicated one, is if you take five steps back, how does the chart look like? Like, does it look like people were getting bored? Does it look like people were just skipping ahead? Often we can just take a step back, not look at the individual drop, but look at the overall chart. And that gives us a message. And then rather than doing a deep analysis, we can start looking at one of my favorites, which is progression, right? Progression is the rate at which we proceed towards our goal in the video or what we've promised. And if that is low, people get bored. If that is high and we get a good pacing, people will stay watching for longer. So that's those are the three levels for people to think about.
Are there any common mistakes that you see or patterns? Again, like the lowest hanging fruit for like, you know, there's a creator who gets 10 million views per video, but like they're making something, such an obvious mistake, they could be getting 50 million views.
Even if people make 50 million views, it's the same mistakes over and again. The brand deals with a full minute integration where you say, so in this video, we're sponsored by blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
The problem is you're being too announcing. You're not integrating it well. You're also coming with irrelevant information, descriptive information before you talk about what's relevant to the viewer, right? I don't want to describe what vidIQ is. I just want to say why vidIQ is good for you, for example. And then lastly, at the end, when the story is over, when your video is over, move on. The video is done. I don't need to hear 1 minute or 2 minute more of your story because we're easing the viewer out. Leave them on that high of wow, and then cut it off. And don't watch more videos. But if you let them strangle on, well, they're not going to watch more videos. So that's two big mistakes that even at 10 million plus views, you see this happen a lot. So that's common mistakes.
I'm curious how annoyed brands were when YouTube introduced a tool which shows the most replayed part of a video on a timeline, because it's always like has a really high peak mountain where the person ends the brand integration. And like, I know now to just automatically skip to that point in the video, which is curious.
You took inspiration from other platforms that have this chart, and It is an attempt to increase viewer satisfaction, and I can see how it does that. But definitely for brands, right? This could be a hurdle. But I'm gonna make one call out to brands: stop forcing people to say the same boring speech. Listen to creators, look at their retention charts. Because if you're just gonna force them to say something, I can tell you that sales are not gonna go higher. They care about money. If you want more money, let the creators integrate it and look at conversion rather than forcing them to say, this brand is this and this is what we do. No, give them their freedom. That's what they're good at. Let a creator do their work. So that's my word for brands that want good conversion.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Tube Talk, brought to you by vidIQ. Head over to vidIQ.com/TubeTalk for today's show notes and previous episodes. Enjoy the rest of your video making day.